Today's show is brought to you by Traeger Grills. Buy a Traeger. There's nothing like good meat, good smoked meat. They have a super smoke setting. I use it all the time. Everyone's like, how did you get it so smoky? I'm like, I use the super smoke setting. You can do it on your phone. You can check the temperature on your phone. You can show your friends on your phone. The phone is where it's at. You can do whatever you want. Everything's tied in. It's a technology company, really, as much as it's a grill company. If you like meat, you like technology, and if you like eating good meat alongside technology, then Traeger's for you.
Well said. Well said.
That's Traeger.com. We better make sure that's the actual. I've never actually been there. Traeger.com. Go buy a Traeger grill, and you're going to really enjoy it. And now, let's Beehive. You are looking at live on a Wednesday. Boys of Wednesday, boy, are you alive? My name is Clint Betts.
My name is Chris Roll.
How are you? You doing good?
Yeah, I'm good.
How's the wind been treating you? A lot of wind?
Yeah. I braved the elements nicely the last 2 days in golf, yeah. So I'm proud of myself.
I'm hating this wind. It's too much.
Ugh. Yeah, we live in a windy area. Comes and it goes. You learn to love the wind, Clint. It's part of your life, okay?
Huh. Garth Brooks has a song about the wind.
That's where I pulled that from. Yes, that's exactly.
The wind is once again calling him back home.
That's exactly.
All right, there's actually a lot going on today, so let's get straight to it. But first, quick word from our sponsor, Traeger. Here's Today in the Beehive.
With your masquerading and you always contemplating what to do in case heaven is found. Hey, come on, baby.
Yesterday, the police officer accused of murdering George Floyd was convicted of all three counts of just that, murder. President Joe Biden praised the verdict and called it a step forward. Minnesota's attorney general said this was just the beginning. And Nancy Pelosi said this.
Thank you, George Floyd, for sacrificing your life for justice. For being there to call out to your mom. How heartbreaking was that? Call out for your mom. I can't breathe. But because of you and because of thousands, millions of people around the world who came out for justice, your name will always be synonymous with justice. And now we have to make sure justice prevails in the sentencing. But that's, you know, that's its own procedure.
Here's what Utah Jazz owner Ryan Smith tweeted yesterday. He said, let's put it up on the screen. My thoughts are with George Floyd's family following his tragic murder and today's verdict. We must all actively work toward meaningful systemic change. And the Utah Jazz put out a statement. Here's the statement the Utah Jazz put out. Our hearts are with the George Floyd family today. His murder among too many examples of senseless killings. Systemic racism and injustice has only heightened the urgency to peacefully and emphatically work towards creating sustainable and meaningful change. The work ahead of us remains clear, our resolve is strong, and our actions must be even stronger. Tyler Childers is one of my favorite musicians. As I thought about what to say today, a song he wrote titled Long Violent History, kept coming to mind. His words are better than mine, so I figured I'd share them with you. It's the worst that it's been since the last time it happened. It's happening again right in front of our eyes. There's updated footage, wild speculation, tall tales and hearsay, and absolute lies. Been passed off as factual, when actually the actual causes they're awkwardly blocking the way keeping us all from enjoying our evening, shoving its roots through the screens in our face. Now, what would you get if you heard my opinion, conjecturing on matters that I ain't never dreamed, in all my born days as a white boy from Hickman, based on the way that the world's been to me? It's called me belligerent. It's took me for ignorant. But it ain't never once made me scared just to be. Could you imagine just constantly worrying, kicking and fighting, begging to breathe? How many boys could they haul off this mountain, shoot full of holes, cuffed and laid in the streets, till we come into town in a stark raven anger, looking for answers and armed to the teeth? 30-odd sixes, Papa's old pistol, how many you reckon? Would it be 4 or 5? Oh, would that be the start of a long, violent history of tucking our tails as we try to abide? Yesterday, I came across an excerpt from Martin Luther King Jr.'s final speech. The speech he gave the night before he was assassinated. It's worth watching today. It's worth watching every day.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Dieters love talking about their diet. Why, though? So, Clint, I've had many people in my life, you know this, friendly man, a man who's accumulated friends, family, strangers. They just come, they flock to me, you know, and I go, I like this about you, and I don't like this about you as much. And I can forgive a lot of things, you know. One of the things that constantly sticks in my craw that I come across is people who are always telling me how unhealthy this specific thing may be, right? And that really manifests itself in the food world. There's nothing worse than when you have the person, you know, you go, oh, I'd like to eat this hamburger or something, or maybe something that's not even that bad. You go, here I am, I'm eating this granola bar. And the next thing you know, you got one of your friends in your face and they go, you know how much sugar is in that particular granola bar? And you go, no, I don't know how much sugar is in this. Why would I know that? Why would I even care about this? I'm eating a granola bar. There's nothing about this that I want to indulge in right now, right? This place that I used to work at, I had a guy who is very health conscious, right? Which is great. I presently, in present day, am a health conscious individual. The problem was at the time, I would eat relatively healthy, you know, but even whatever I was consuming, he would always feel necessary to go, actually, you know, that salad there that you're eating, so those cranberries, those are bad for you. Let me explain why. And no matter what you were eating, it was always a problem. No matter what it was.
Here's the thing about dieters. Everything you eat is bad for you.
This is a very interesting point you're bringing up and is applied to everything, okay? Which is anything you do is always bad, yeah. Right? And everybody knows it.
Absolutely.
I never sit there and do something and I go, and somebody goes, Chris, do you know that that's actually way bad for you? And I go, oh my gosh, wait, what? Like I'm sitting here behind this car and breathing in the fumes from the tailpipe and that's actually bad for me? Who could have ever guessed?
It's stupid. I'll be like, I'm on a nice little diet. I'll have like 2 Winston cigarettes in my mouth. I'll be smoking them. You're like, oh, you shouldn't smoke cigarettes. It's better. What? What can you do? What can you do if not that?
When was the last time you saw somebody and said, you shouldn't do that? Not that you shouldn't do that, but you go, do you know that's bad for you?
Never.
Never in your whole life. Not once.
I would never do that. What do I care? We're all going to die. That's the fascinating thing about diets. We're all going to die.
That is the fascinating thing about
diets.
Yeah,
so what does it matter?
Well, it doesn't really at all. So tying into that thing of like people who always tell you that's bad for you, this isn't, it goes hand in hand with the dieters. And sometimes it's that style of person. And other times it's just somebody who goes, you know, I'm getting into this diet and I feel compelled to tell you about that diet, which is just as miserable for the person who's on the receiving end. Because now I'm sitting there and I'm minding my own business, having a grand day, you know, I'm typing away, I'm working for this segment. I'm going, oh, I'm going to find all these cool things. Next thing you know, you walk through the door and you go, well, Chris, 3 straight days on keto. And I go, here we go. And I got to listen to a full rundown. You know, you're going, so actually, carrots have carbohydrates, so I don't eat
those.
Well,
it's fascinating what your body does when it's in ketosis.
Okay, explain. Okay. Please explain.
It's life extending, which I enjoy. I enjoy life extending. You know what I always find about dieters, too? They're also usually workouters. Is that what you call them?
Yes, workouters. That's exactly what you call
them. So they're workouters, and they'll get on, like, these bikes. You know, the road bikes that are, like, super skinny and stuff. And then they'll do this super tight. Have you seen this tight stuff that these bikers on the road wear?
I have.
It's super tight, like spandex. They look like pieces of fruit.
Not a great look.
They look crazy. And then they're like telling me, hey, you can't smoke 2 Winstons at the same time. And I'm like, hey, you're going to get hit by a car and die. We'll see who dies first.
And then you try to indeed
run
them over.
And then I run them over with my car.
Which is kind of the problem.
And what do you want?
What's weird about the bikers is it's already strange when you see them biking on the road. It's freaky as hell when you see them off the bike and they're walking around. Because
those clothes don't
translate to everyday life.
Why can't bikers have better clothing?
There's no explanation. It's because it goes into the health nut thing of like, I'm so proud. Now you have to see every crevice of my body. And I'm like, I mean, I just don't feel the need to see that.
Not even Brad Pitt looks good in these outfits. And you're like, oh, that's not true. Actually, it is. He was in a Coen Brothers movie and he wore this spandex and he looked hideous.
What are you talking about?
No one looks good in this clothing. Why are people wearing it? And then they're drinking smoothies and kale and telling me I can't smoke cigarettes.
The last time I went to...
I look way better than them.
You definitely look way better. I would pay a decent amount of money to see you in biking spandex. And I'm actually not joking. Oh. I would crowdfund... I'm sure that people who watch and listen to this show would be willing to donate money to get you in spandex on our... We'd raise up these desks. You'd do it standing. And we'd have a full body cam that would just be you talking the whole time. Just disproportionate as can be.
You would see things you do not want to see.
When you see every crevasse of the Clint Betts body, you don't come back from that.
Even I would be grossed out.
So you do intermittent fasting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Really good. You should do it. And the fact that you don't do it is not good for your health.
Yes.
I don't know why you're not doing it. You really need to do it.
How many years do you think have tacked on to the end of your life?
I'd probably say, a few decades.
I'll give you props. You do a pretty good balance of, you tell people you're intermittently fasting, which is already annoying, but you don't go too deep into it. Usually one falls the other where you go, Oh yeah, I actually have been intermittent fasting. So how that works is I don't eat until lunchtime, and then I eat everything under the sun for an hour, and then I don't eat again for 6 hours. Then I eat even more for dinner.
Well, here's my thing about intermittent fasting. First of all, I won't even bring it up unless you offer me food when I'm fasting. Then I'm going to have to say why I'm not getting the food. Number two, it's the dumbest thing to explain. It takes 2 seconds. You eat for a period of time and then you don't eat the rest of the time. The people who go way deep on it, it's like, oh, unbelievable. So if you at noon you eat, at 6 you eat, and it's like, yeah, I get it. I get what it is. It's way
just within the name, I immediately got it. You fast intermittently.
It's the most simple thing to explain, and the people who go deep on it, it's crazy.
At least for the keto people, I go, I don't know what I don't know what that is. And they go, you've never heard of ketosis? And I go, when would I have heard of ketosis until this diet fad popped up?
I've never tried keto. I bet I would like it. It's been ruined for me because I have friends who do keto and they talk about it incessantly.
In your face, dude.
And they eat huge sticks of butter.
There's a lot of butter.
I'm like, I don't want to eat butter.
What I hated is anytime I would eat a vegetable around a ketosis person, they go, you do know that has carbs. And I go, I assume everything has carbs. I assume everything has everything in it. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm just eating this thing.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to talk about it. I don't ever go around and talk about what I'm eating. It's the worst trait. You know, you get people on any of the extremes. You get a vegan. You know, we know vegans, and they come to us and they're always talking about, well, actually, you shouldn't eat this, and I only eat this kind of seaweed. And I go, that's cool, that's fine, I just don't want to hear about it. Mm-hmm. Then you go to the other side, and it's like these big, hefty carnivores, and they're like showing me pictures of their meat on their phones, and they're like, yeah, that comes from my friend Bob's grill, and we spent 12 hours touching it with their hands to get the meat ready.
So first of all, I'm way fascinated by the second one. I would talk to the second person for a very long time.
No,
would you not?
No, you don't want to talk to either.
What type of grill does he have? I have so many questions already.
Were you touching the meat simultaneously?
How long were you there? What was the internal temp of the meat? I would be so excited about the second one. The first one, like, I eat eels and seaweed, is like, ew, gross, get out of here.
The seaweed thing is more interesting than you think. Because I have seaweed people in my life, and they'll pop out.
Who do you know?
I have two different
people. I swear I'm around you most of the time. Like, I swear like he knows like two people, and all of a sudden like he knows all these seaweed people.
I know tons of people. I have two very seaweed people in my life.
And Kelly?
Anytime I'm around them, definitely not Kelly. Anytime I'm around them, they'll pop out. They always have strange snacks, and they usually come from Good Earth, which is like a natural foods establishment, right? And they'll pull something out. And they know that I'm like a health conscious person. So they always go, Chris, you want some of this? And they'll pull out. The last time this happened, it was a big like seaweed sheet. An actual sheet. You know, like a 10 by 12 piece of paper. And it's in his golf bag. And he goes, Chris, you're going to love this. So he hands out. It looks like paper. It looks like a canister of paper. And I go, I mean, like, am I taking notes now? I don't know what's going on. He goes, oh, no. It's this new seaweed stuff. It's super good. And so now I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. I didn't feel like I could turn it down because he was so convinced I would like it. So I take the – it's huge. It's a big sheet. So I take the sheet. I'm going to the next hole. It's a hard hole, and I'm trying to keep my head in the game. Now I'm obligated to eat an enormous sheet of seaweed before I get to the tee shot, the hardest tee shot on the whole course. And I'm like – so I crunch some into it. It's not good. It's a sheet of seaweed dried. How could it be good?
Of course it's not good.
So I crunch a little bit, and I'm like, I mean, yeah, it's pretty – it is, yeah, I get it, he goes. And then he starts listing some of the health facts, which I just don't really think they exist. It's like, this isn't anything for you, and by virtue of that, that's where the health lies. I'm just like, yeah, this is pretty crazy. This is good stuff. And I'm just like, I don't know how I got into this situation. However, you said you'd much rather hang out with the meat people. The meat people, though,
sure.
Like, this reminds me of a time we had a barbecue, a big barbecue, for like thousands of people over at our Silicon Slopes office in Lehigh. And for some reason that I still to this day don't understand, you were with the meat houses, you know? Yeah. They pulled you in. They put an apron on you, and they're
listen,
like,
listen, that's where I'm going
to
be.
Clint, we want you to be a part of this. So at one point, you and this, like, super jovial meat guy, like this big, sweet barbecue chef master, you and him are there in front of a huge brisket, and you're both, like, touching it simultaneously. You're like, and he's on one side, and you're both, like, kind of kneading it.
I was kneading.
And there's pictures of this event where you're grinning with this other guy, and he's grinning on the other end of a brisket. And you're both so happy. And as soon as I saw the picture, I was just like, I don't want to know what was going on there. I don't ever want to talk about this again. This is just as freaky as my seaweed experience. I don't care which extreme you're on. It's too much for me.
He let me cut some of the brisket. It was cool.
It's like the little kid.
He's like, here you go, buddy.
No, you hold the knife.
He gives me a butter knife.
Now don't you hold worry. The knife away from you. Let's start there. No, no, no. Don't ever point it at somebody. You, oh, sorry. Okay. Two hands.
That was a big moment
two
for me.
Hand slicing of the brisket.
That was the Traeger master. He's the master Traeger. That's what he does.
Yeah, he was the master Traeger.
He knows everything there is to know.
So I want to give a quote to you from Town and Country Magazine because
hell yeah.
It's a sweet, sweet magazine and it ties into what we're talking about. So they have a thing about diets. Okay, here's the quote. Like so many other subjects, your sexual proclivities, your spouse or lover's sexual proclivities, your dental hygiene regimen, diets are subjects best left to you and your healthcare professional, your shrink, your minister slash priest slash rabbi slash imam, or your best friend. End quote. So I have part of this I like.
Well, I don't like any of it.
I do like the, hey, listen, your diet talk, you know, talking about all the meat, talking about all the seaweed. You got to keep that confined to a very closed circle. Now, I do feel bad for a lot of these people listed. First of all, that's not your best friend's duties, okay? Yeah. A best friend's duties do not involve listening to a talk about a diet. In actuality, that's like the way that you ruin a relationship with a best friend. Okay?
What are you, like, let's say you had a best friend.
Okay. I know a lot of people. I don't have a best friend.
What would that entail for you? Like, what do you feel like your responsibilities would be?
For me? Yeah. I don't have a responsibility. That's the point of being a best friend. See, that's what I hate about the best friend stuff. You got to do this and you got to do this. No, 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 no. A true good union, you go, hey, I'm chill with you, you're chill with me. You don't have responsibilities in relation to me, and I don't either. That's like a good relationship. Mm. When relationships sink down into the depths is, you're my best friend, you gotta do this. And then you gotta listen to me talk about ketosis for 2 hours. And then when I'm sad, you gotta come over and comfort me and do this or that. Okay, that's fine.
You wouldn't do the comfort?
Oh, I gotta go. Oh, I gotta go put my arm around you. I go, it's okay, you're gonna be a master chef someday. I know you sliced your finger today at the barbecue, but you're gonna be fine, buddy. I'm never gonna be the master chef. It's too much work, right? Ran into being a best friend is just like, you exist and the other person exists. And sometimes you cross paths. That's how a good union works.
That seems like a very casual relationship.
That's a great relationship. You can have a casual best friend. There's nothing that says.
I like that.
There's nothing that says you can't have a casual best friend. Mm. Like you see somebody once a year and every time they walk by, it's in passing. Mm. And you're with someone else. You go, that's my best friend. Don't even say hi. That's a good union. That's something we're talking about. Back to this quote, though. So there's a lot of stuff in here. I don't know. When you're like, you're a shrink, you're a healthcare professional, you're a minister, I don't necessarily know what you're signing up for, but in my mind, it's not this, where like, they come in, imagine you go in, you know, to your healthcare professional. I got a doctor, he's old as hell. He's like 89, he's so freaking old. And every time I come in, he can't even see me in the room. He's like, and he looks around, I'm like, oh, doctor. And he's like, there you are. It's a tiny room. It's so tiny. Imagine if he walks in, he goes, hello, how are you?
Tell me about your spouse's sexual proclivities.
And I go, listen, dude, I got some sexual proclivities that are going to blow your mind.
Okay, why'd they say your spouse's sexual proclivities?
Like, have you ever gone to somebody and you go, so, I mean, I got to get the details. What are your spouse's sexual proclivities? You would come off as such a creep. Even asking that of somebody already sounds very bizarre. It's not like, hey, Clint, like, have you had sex recently? That's already a little bit weird.
Yeah.
If I said, Clint, what are your sexual proclivities? And you had to tell them to me.
No, imagine what I would tell you.
You go, okay, I'm so glad you asked. Right. Let's start with the intermittent fasting, kind of how it ties into
the Have you ever heard of peanut butter? You got to get your protein in. That's a big part of it.
You would be the worst case scenario because you would blend the dieting side with your sexual proclivities. And you're like, we're going to have all the subjects rolled into one. my proclivities, my spouse's sexual proclivities, my own dieting habits, my intermittent fasting.
I do intermittent sexual proclivities.
That's
what's interesting.
Good idea.
So I am like, all right, let's start. But in a second here, we're going to have to stop.
Yes.
And we're going to have to fast for a bit. Okay.
It's actually kind of a intermittent sexuality is honestly sexuality. A baller idea.
Intermittent sexuality. I might start that as a movement. I was born in the wrong place. I was born in Utah. If I would have been born in Alabama, there is no question I would be a pastor in the woods. Talk it like a tent, and I'd be asking my congregation about their sexual proclivities. Do you not think I would be doing
Why
that?
Why can't you do that here?
You can't do that here.
I love the idea that the only place you can set up a tent in the woods and ask about sexual proclivities is in Alabama. I do that every day,
TV?
And I've lived in Utah for
a
very long time.
FX or AMC? All those shows are like Alabama, Tennessee, that type of thing. Like, I've never seen one in Utah where they're like, oh, look at these backwoods people in Utah.
Well, that's a great opening for you and I. You know, I'd be like a good side pastor, like the low-level pastor who doesn't know the doctrine, but he's willing to lend a helping hand.
You'd be the guy who's like sweeping during the sermon.
Exactly. And I got the
Let
cool,
me just clean up here.
Like, I would cut such a figure in a woolly brown robe with the old rope belt around. And I'm just booming. And I sidle up to the person I'm most attracted to in the congregation, and I'm like, so what's your sexual proclivities, miss? My name's Chris, pastor boy. I don't know what my title would be.
Probably
pastor boy. But I would have that. I could go and I could ask people about that. And they would have to answer because they go, normally I don't want to talk about this or my diet with anybody. He's not my best friend, but he is a pastor boy. And so I'll be willing to talk to him.
I like intermittent sexuality. This is a new movement we need to do. Like, and I would love the idea of explaining it to people. Like, people explain intermittent fasting.
Yes.
So I only can have sexual relations at 6 p.m. Monday and Wednesdays. Otherwise.
But here's what's cool about it. Monday and Wednesday, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Just like intermittent fasters. Yeah, it's an orgy. You invite 60 people and you go,
get it out of our system.
This hour is going to be nuts. And then as soon as it's done, you go into work the next day and everybody's like, you look atrocious. What happened? You go, I'm on this new intermittent sexuality kick. I had an orgy last night with 60 people. I feel terrible. I feel like I was run over by 6 dump trucks. I don't know what I'm doing. I met this pastor guy in the woods. And he kind of invited me to this new thing. I don't really know what's going on there. This is a great – I do think there's a fantastic opportunity for an intermittent sexuality movement. I think we can spearhead it. And I actually take umbrage with the statement that, oh, we're in the wrong place for that. Like, we're actually in the perfect place for that because Utah has a very complicated past and present with how it approaches sexuality. And so anytime you can throw something off the wall, you go, hey, listen, we know sex – freaky, freaky, freaky. You ever heard of intermittent sexuality? That's the good stuff.
Okay.
And it's like, it's kind of chaste, you know, because the intermittent part speaks to the soul of Utah where we go, yeah, I don't really like sex, but intermittently, that seems okay. Like it's just a little indulgence every once in a while. That speaks to the soul, right?
I like it. Okay. I think Utah might be a good place for this. Although my experience with Utah is free. When it comes to sexuality, total freedom.
Because
you can do whatever you want. Probably the freest state in the country.
Are you not going to explain
when it comes
that?
I'm just telling you my experience.
Is that because you've always asked people about their proclivities and they answer? Or what is this based upon?
Well, I just like the word proclivities.
Have you ever asked, this is an honest question, have you ever asked somebody in your life, like, hey, what's your, what is your sexual proclivities? What are they? Or what are your spouses?
Yeah, I asked my son recently. Like, you gotta calm down.
You gotta.
You're 15. Like, let's have this talk.
Have you had a sex talk with your kids yet?
Oh,
when does that happen? What age does that happen? I'm always curious about that.
For me, it was a week ago.
Oh, okay.
Well, your proclivities are.
There are noises coming out of his room. Just people are filing out at night, and you're just sitting there alone on the couch. You're like, I better have the talk.
We need to have this talk because your proclivities are getting out of control.
So every night at 6 p.m., I hear a lot of stuff coming out of your room.
Let me tell you something about intermittent sexuality, son.
Here's my question to you. When I was growing up, like, like my family, it was a closed doors thing with sex. They're like, we don't even want to think about it. Like intermittent sexuality would have worked nicely. We're like, we don't want to talk about that. So I'd go in my own room and it was, nobody asked what was happening, right?
What a freak show house. You had a closed door policy when it came to sex?
Closed door. I got the tie around the knob. I'm 12. My parents are like, don't go in Chris's room. Stay away.
Looks like his proclivities are coming out.
I come out, arm around just six women. I'm a man. Can't even believe what you can do in present day. The 90s are a crazy time. No, so like, as part of the growing up process, like the sex talk, I don't even remember one vividly, like coming from my parents, because I think they were like, I don't even know how to deal with this. But I remember one vividly coming at school. Mm. And then at the church that I grew up in, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, those two different times, we'd go in there, and I'm just, like, squirming in my seat. And they go, this is what sex is, and this is how you do it. I'm like, you're talking to a seasoned pro, okay?
We got a closed-door policy at my house.
You guys ever heard of the closed-door policy? What goes on in the bedroom stays in the bedroom. So it wasn't something you talked about. So as I got older, I always was interested because I'm like, yeah, that sex talk, that was super weird for me. But then once I became an adult, I'm like, it sounds like something that would be so funny to mm-hmm. go and talk about with your kid. Like you going to a 15-year-old mm-hmm. and you're like, and you trying to be serious. Now take a seat here on the couch, son.
Take a seat. I try to make it super awkward. You know, like, this little part, like the lat.
Yeah.
I grab the lat of my son and I'm like, come here, dude.
That's a trap, but yeah, the lat's down here. I don't want to like reveal my bodybuilding past. But...
So I grab the trap and the lat. And I'm like, hey.
You're just double clawing him. Now sit down. Let me tell you face to face.
Let me tell you something. I heard the Rawl House, you should have this closed door policy. We might implement it.
I know
here.
The Betzes are more into kind of the open door policy. Like, we kind of lay everything out on the table.
We're going to try this because your proclivities are getting a little out of hand.
So, is it an intense experience or is it just kind of a funny experience?
It's probably intense for my son. For me, it's.
Yeah, that's
awesome.
What I'm asking. I'm asking for you.
Yeah, for me, I love it. I love it. Okay. I make it as weird as possible.
It's definitely intense for the kid. Like, you got a diagram out. You got the pointer where you're like, no, this is the lat. And he's like, Dad, that's the penis. That's not the lat at all. I don't even know how you keep mistaking the lat for that area of the body.
Come here, son. Let me tell you something about hamstrings and how they factor
now,
in
now, when
here.
The lat enters into the trap, he's like, Dad, that's not what those things are. That's not, I don't know how you conceived. You just like misnaming every single muscle group of the entire body. This is the last thing, and then we can wrap up the segment. I want you to, as part of our intermittent sexuality thing, mm-hmm. Utah, it's always controversial about how we teach sex eds. That's like a huge thing, and everybody's always mm-hmm. arguing over it. I think we could get you as the main teacher, and you're up there with the pointer, the muscles, and all the kind of stuff, and you teach your own version of sexuality, whatever that, like, again, I don't know what that may be. Then me, little pastor boy, I have my own class, and people can choose, because mine, I go, I just have a big door, and it's closed, and there's a lock on it, and I point right to the lock, and I go, whatever you do behind closed doors stays behind
closed doors. That's the policy.
That's sex. Everybody's like, wow.
Not mine. I would go deep on lats, and traps, various neck muscles, hamstrings, quads, all the different things.
That's where we're going to head.
They all factor in for
me. That's exactly where we're going to head.
All right. Let's talk some sports. Let's get into some sports. Here is No Baller, but first, quick word from our sponsor, Homie.
Our real estate system is totally broken. You don't have to grow up in a garage to know that. But this kid did and worked and hustled to buy his own house, where he saw all his money go to other people. That's why he created Homie, a new way to sell your home that costs less, a whole lot less. With Homie, you pay one flat fee. You get a professional agent, professional pictures, and your house gets listed all over the internet. Did I tell you that Homie sells homes faster and for more money? Go to Homie.com to find out how. Yeah, we've got your back.
college football is at a crossroads. It kind of hangs suspended between what it once was and whatever it is going to be. We don't really know what that future looks like. And the powers that be that kind of shape the structure of the sport, I also don't really think knows what the future looks like for college football. But that's where we're at. We're at a crossroads, right? Simultaneous to where we're at with the world of college football, Sunday night, the European soccer made a lot of waves because the most notable clubs, all within various leagues throughout Europe, agreed to form a super league, right? They said, we're going to go chase a bunch of money. We're going to form a league that's just us, the most prominent and rich teams. And then that's going to be the new league, right? And people freaked out. This morning, right before we got on the show, a bunch of the teams are now pulling out because the public backlash to this proposed Super League has been so strong and so negative that they go, all right, we're not ready for this. However, it's kind of pointing towards a future that seems almost inevitable at this point, okay? This comes from ESPN. As the globe comes to terms with the inevitability of a Super League upending the structure of European soccer, it's not hard to imagine a series of events that leads to a similar shift in an American sport similarly steeped in more than a century's worth of tradition. With its best teams spread mostly among five regional conferences, all fighting for independent television contracts, college football lends itself to the idea of a Super League in the same way. End quote. So, college football has always been about realignment, right? Every time television contracts are up for renewal, those are bartered individually by each conference, the Big 12, the Big 10, the SEC, and there's always a realignment process that comes with that. The last time this occurred, my favorite team, Nebraska, went from the Big 12 to the Big 10. For local people, you remember Utah going to from the Mountain West to the Pac-12. You remember BYU going from the Mountain West to an independent team. And every time this happens, it's usually every decade or so, you kind of have a reshuffling of the deck, so to speak. And that's how this version of the sport is being shaped and will continue to be shaped for the foreseeable future, right? So you hear about this happening in European soccer, and it's very, very, very soon that I do think that this Super League stuff will come into existence. Despite the fact that they're now saying, we're not actually really into that, right? And over the past few years, as the playoff has become more prominent, and you've really seen, like, there is such a clear separation between the haves and have-nots in college football, that the part of the brain that goes, does it make sense for Alabama to continue to be in a conference playing Vanderbilt in football? Does it make sense for Ohio State to continue to be in a conference playing Rutgers in football? That part of the brain is starting to get more awareness, right? And people are starting to debate this idea of a Super League within college football, right? So I want to read to you another quote. This one comes from Andy Staples of The Athletic, okay? What is the Super League if not the nuclear option version of college sports realignment from a decade ago? In college sports, schools consolidated into leagues to maintain a brighter line between the haves and have-nots. Leagues that added schools did so with the goal of adding to their cable television footprints so more people would pay higher per month subscriber fees for their conference networks. The Super League, meanwhile, would be akin to the 15 most popular football, though not necessarily the most recently accomplished, programs deciding to play games only against one another and outside the confines of their own conferences. End quote. So that kind of sets the stage for one possible road that college football can take. And I understand the lure, you know? Like, the part of me that loves quality football, I think of the idea of Alabama and Ohio State and Clemson and Georgia and LSU and all the powers of college football being in the same conference with very similar resources, with the exact same television contract pouring money into their coffers. And I go, that's pretty interesting, you know? That's about as close to an NFL quality of football that college could actually aspire to obtain, right? In present day, part of the lure of college football is actually that sometimes it's kind of bad. And sometimes it's actually fun watching, you know, a couple MAC teams battle it out on a Tuesday, and the quality does not approach what the NFL is. Like, that is part of the lure. So there's multiple sides to any decision that could possibly be made for the future, right? And I personally, like, it's always hard for me to decide where I stand on all this kind of stuff. I love quality sports. That's usually the number one thing that I care about. I have a very unique relationship with college football because it's been like my ultimate love when it comes to watching sports for my entire life. And the era that I grew up in is very different from where we are currently, and definitely incredibly different from wherever this sport is going to head. And so I'm always trying to find this balance in my mind of the things that I love about college football, what those are, and how they can be still held on to and utilized while also creating this higher quality of football. Okay, I'm going to go back to Andy Staples and read another quote from him. "The economic underpinnings of college football make legislating parity nearly impossible. There won't be a draft or a collective bargaining agreement. Attempts to legislate parity have actually made the issues worse and probably helped cause the current lopsidedness. Those rules robbed athletes for decades of money they should have been allowed to take, and soon will be, thanks to coming name, image, and likeness laws that will force the schools to allow it, while enriching coaches and administrators at a select few schools. Perhaps the coming transfer and economic freedom for athletes will help even out the distribution of talent and give more teams a chance to compete for playoff berths." End quote. So, the optimistic side of college football fans, they kind of echo what Andy's saying within this, which is the name, image, and likeness stuff. That is a huge shift from the past, you know? Money before always went to coaches, administrators, the schools, and the people who played the sport never received anything, and indeed were prevented from making money on their name or their image or their likeness. And that's now changing. And that's a way that schools can attract talent and say, hey, we're a team that maybe isn't known as a national power. Let's say we're Arkansas football. You can come, and because of our passionate fan base, if you can monetize those things correctly, we can offer as much to you monetarily as a really big school where you might kind of be lost in the shuffle. That's a big selling point for my team, Nebraska. That when you look at how they have to recruit against teams that they can't possibly beat in these cross-country recruiting wars, they're not going to go swoop into California and beat Alabama and Ohio State constantly in recruiting battles. A name and image and likeness thing, that's a big boost for a program like that, because you go, listen, Nebraska does have one of the most passionate fan bases in college football. And depending on how you go about your business, there's a lot of options for you to make money just by virtue of being a football player at our school, right? The second part of that, he talks about the new transfer rule that's coming into effect. Before, when you transferred from a school to a school, you'd have to sit out a year. Not a fair rule. No one really ever knows why it existed. It just did. And now they're breaking that down. They're going, it makes no sense. So if you want to transfer from a school, you can transfer to that school and you can play the following season, right? And that's a big deal, because it schools that recruit the very best talent. I'll go back to the powers that be, Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, Georgia, those kinds of things. They have rosters that are filled with NFL talent, including you get to their second and third and even fourth string people. Like, there are quality football players that would possibly be very good on another team, but because they're there at that school, they don't necessarily have that opportunity. And once you realize that you're third or fourth on the pecking chart at Alabama, and you don't have to sit out a year when you transfer, there's a lot more opportunity for that talent to be distributed just by virtue of saying, okay, hey, you know what? Tennessee needs a wide receiver, and I'm fifth on the depth chart at Alabama. I'm going to go there. Now I'm the second wideout. I actually might be good. I mean, how many times do we see teams from or players from those schools go and be drafted in the NFL and actually be very successful when we never almost saw them in college? There's a lot of opportunity for that distribution of talent, right? So that's the optimistic side. That's like, if you're trying to imagine a world where college football isn't just this have and have not separation that it has been in the past, but because of the lack of a playoff, it kind of evened the playing field. If you lost one game, you a lot of times couldn't play for the national title. So it was a playoff every week, right? Whereas now, because of the playoff, you have the opportunity to lose a game, and the playoff committee is still going to bring you back. And that means that, like, the most talented teams, yeah, even if they slip up, they're still going to be there at the end, right? There's always this balance that we're trying to find. And strangely enough, like, college football is kind of living in its own pseudo-super league. Everybody's in their own individual conferences, but when push comes to shove and it's the end of the year, the playoff has shown us. I did a full segment about this, I believe, 2 weeks ago. The playoff has been virtually the same teams every single year since it's been instituted. Oklahoma's there, Ohio State's there, Clemson's there, Alabama's there. And that doesn't look like it's going to change. And even with this, the new name, image, and likeness stuff, even with the transfer stuff, it's a sport that is catered towards those powers. And there's a line from Andy Staples that really sticks out there. The economic underpinnings of college football make legislating parity nearly impossible. That's the thing that I always go back to. And no matter how optimistic I get, I go, the way that this sport is structured, it's no matter how many rules you change and all that kind of stuff, it's nearly impossible to take away that. It's nearly impossible to turn this sport into the NFL. Even if a Super League were to come into existence, which again, I get, it makes sense, it sounds appealing, I don't know if that's what it turns into. Or if it just becomes, we have the consistently five really good teams that are here, and then we have USC and UCLA and Michigan, and you know, maybe Nebraska makes it in there based on their past, and they're still just not very good relative to these teams. I don't know. I don't know what that would actually look like. I do know that college football itself is kind of based upon the deception that every team has a chance, which is not true. We've seen that in the past, in the pre-playoff era. I'll go back to when Boise State was awesome and beating really good teams consistently and was never allowed a seat at the national title table. And I'll go into the playoff era, excuse me, and talk about when UCF went undefeated in a very good American Athletic Conference and just monster mashed Auburn in the Peach Bowl, an Auburn team that actually beat the national champion that year in Alabama, and they were undefeated, and they had every right to probably get into that 14 playoff and play, and instead the playoff committee was just like, you're not really one of these teams. You're not Alabama. You're not Clemson. You're not Oklahoma, so we don't really have room for you, right? So that deception is what kind of drives me insane in present day. In an ideal world, you would say every team does have a chance, and I think that's where college football is headed in the immediate future, which is we're going to expand our playoff. And that comes with its whole can of worms, right? And I don't necessarily think that opens doors in the way that we think it opens doors. I think that just means the teams that are the best and the teams that have the most stacked rosters with talent, again, the exact same teams I keep talking about, those teams will always be there and they will always win the national championship. And so we get to a point where it's just like, we have an 8-team playoff. These are the conference champions. Here's your non-Power 5 team. Who are the final four? It's Alabama, it's Clemson, it's Ohio State, it's Oklahoma. So that crossroads moment, you can expand the playoff, you can go the Super League direction, you can find something else. I don't know what that possibly would be. The part of it that really bums me out is a person who's followed this closely their whole life. Like, a real huge draw of college football for me and what, like, distinguishes it from other sports is there's so much difference between all of these teams, how they play, what their fan bases are like, how big those fan bases are, what styles they use, their stadiums themselves, and how, like, I can go down the list for all of time just saying how much different within the same sport a team like BYU is versus a team like Coastal Carolina, who we watched play last year. Like, there's so much disparity in how these teams play and then how these teams are actually followed, yet it all falls under this umbrella of the same sport. And that's something that, like, always spoke to me, because you don't really have that in anything else, especially at a professional level. And the further along college football goes, we're getting to a point where, like, that's really being pushed to the side. And the past, and part of that centuries-old tradition that ESPN mentions at the top of this segment, that's being pushed away, and you can't really get that back. Like, again, I'll speak to being a Nebraska fan. I loved that my entire childhood and into early adulthood, that revolved around the college football season being similar yet different. Nebraska would play the same teams, and I knew every day after Thanksgiving they would play Colorado. And I know they're always going to have this game against Kansas State, and they're always going to have every other year against Texas. And there were all of these sweet geographic tie-ins and conference tie-ins, and you'd build up these rivalries, and you learned all these things about all these teams. And then you had your non-conference schedule where you could schedule in these other teams, and you got a taste of the rest of the country. And it was a really cool way of exploring tradition with the new, right? And now Nebraska moved to the Big Ten a little over 10 years ago. And, like, it still hasn't sunk in that they're a Big Ten member to me. Like, I don't get the same rise out of watching them play Iowa the week of Thanksgiving. And I don't get the same rise out of watching them play Ohio State, despite the fact that Ohio State's one of the very best college football teams. And I know people will hear that and go, part of that has to be tied in because Nebraska is bad at football. And that may be true. But I think a lot of it is tied into just the fact of I loved that familiarity. I loved being able to compare over the course of decades, like, oh, this Colorado game today in 2005 reminds me of this Colorado game in 1992 and how this happened and how this happened. Oh, that reminds me of that Colorado game in 1996 and all this kind of stuff. Like, I love that as a sports fan and people who follow the sport closely. Like, that's a really big emotional component that comes with following the sport that I don't think is ever coming back. And that's part of this entire discussion that, like, there is no clear-cut answer. It seems to me personally that college football is at the point of you're probably going to have to choose the lesser of two evils for how someone like me will consume it. The part about it that bums me out is that, like, the thing about college football that I truly loved in the past, it's not here anymore. And it's not really something that can come back. And so that might just be a sad and depressing way of me saying, like, you just kind of got to get with the times and whatever college football is moving forward. Like, I will still watch it and consume it because I just love football in general. And maybe, you know, it's time for me to just go, all right, let's just embrace the new shift. And if that's Super League, so be it. And if it's a big playoff, so be it. And I'll just kind of give it a chance in that manner. So that's what's on my mind today, college football. It's always on my mind, and we will finish off the show with Dear Clint.
Rags. There is a reason everyone is talking about Rags. From baby to teen, Rags makes parents' lives easier by outfitting kiddos of all ages. Rags features an elastic neckline for easy on and off dressing, which saves you time. No more annoying snaps to deal with. Just pull up and on. No more annoying snaps. Style Rags, hundreds of ways with butter soft outfits, perfect for everyday wear. Parenting is hard, and Rags is here to make it a bit comfier and easier. Shop all the goodness at rags.com. There are so many ways to interact with me on an individual basis, personally. If you'd like to reach out, you can. I'll put out my cell phone. I need friends. I'm not like Chris. I don't have tons of friends. I don't know people who eat seaweed. I don't know all these people.
I got some people.
I know very few people. But if you want to interact with Dear Clint, Weston just put up how to do it. Very easy. Not a lot to it. DearClint@thebeehive.com.
Why are you so somber? What's going on, buddy?
Let's read today's Dear Clint. Okay. I'll tell you why. Dear Clint, it brings me no joy to write to you today. I find myself at a crossroads, and I'm not sure how you or anyone can help. You see, I was told the Uinta Mountains would be open yesterday. I was lied to. They're not open. And I'll never feel the peace they bring again. My question to you is this. What's the point?
What's the point, dude? I did notice that you showed up in your Dodgers paraphernalia today.
I'm never dressing like a mountain man again.
I was going to say, I just thought you'd burned yourself out yesterday.
Mm-mm.
I thought you dressed up like a Western cowboy scarecrow and you'd gone around the mountains and you go, I'm super, okay, let's give it a break. That took a toll on my body. What I'm finding out is you lied to.
Here's the thing. It says you went to...
Who lied to you?
You went to Mountains open April 20th. They always say that. April 20th every
year. Who does? Who?
Oh, the state of Utah. Or federal government? I don't know how it works. I think it's a federal...
Is it like on a sign somewhere and there's like a road that's
sign.
Blocked?
Okay. It's like April 20th. So they open one gate. So I get up a little bit. I'm like, oh, yes. We're open. We're going. I get up a little bit. Closed gate. I can't go.
So the first gate's open April 20th, but right after there's another gate. So April 28th. Sorry. And you have to do each segment? Is that what it is?
I have
Why is it still closed?
I don't know. I'm so sad. I don't know who you'd reach out to. I don't know. Is this why people call congressmen, senators? I would love to call someone and be like,
Who's our local representative that we should call?
I don't know.
Let's swap them, dude.
My question to the audience is like, who do we call to get the Uinta Mountains open so I can go?
So this might be a dumb question, but why are the mountains closed? And how do you close mountains?
This is my number one point. Okay. We own these mountains. These are our mountains. You can put a fence around my mountains?
Yeah.
My mountains. I pay taxes for it?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Isn't it just one gate on one road? I don't really understand how you close the mountains.
There's a gate.
How does that work?
Do it at the steep where it's like straight down both sides. And so you can't bring your side by side around because you fall off the mountain and die.
So there's only one access point to an entire mountain?
I mean, there could be other access points. I'm not super familiar with the Uinta Mountains.
Like,
I've only been there
like
once or
Burger
twice.
Burger King.
I don't know much about the Uinta Mountains.
A mountain's a very big thing.
I'm so bothered. Hot and bothered, really.
I am too.
I'm hot and bothered. About the fact that on April 20th, I was told the Uinta Mountains are open. They open one tiny gate. Oh, here you go. Get you all excited. And then they close the gate that actually gets you up there. Okay, that's annoying.
I need
to get up there.
I would love to write a letter to my own. Do I write? I'm not sure if I write it to a congressman.
I don't know who you write it to. That's the thing that's so frustrating. And obviously this person as well tried the exact same thing. Like, who do you write? Who do you contact? He said, I don't think you can help me. And I don't think anyone else can. That's exactly how I felt. Who could help me?
My problem with contacting politicians is in your mind, you go, this is sweet. My congressman is going to open up this letter and read it and then take it to heart. But it's just some Beavis aide, you know, they're like, some guy's mad about a mountain not being open. Do we have anything to do with that? And the congressman's like, how would we open a mountain? What does that even mean? And he's like, I'm just going to throw that. That's probably some kid or something. I don't know.
Dear Mitt, the gate was closed when I tried to get up.
Dear Mitt, you promised April 20th. But it's
Are you going to hold up your word?
But you didn't know that. But I didn't know there was a next gate.
I'm
Will
so
you
bothered.
Talk to President Biden?
Open up the Uinta Mountains. Hashtag open up the mountains.
Don't write it.
Open Uinta.
I will say this is a very easy way for a politician to make change. Do you not agree?
Yeah. Hashtag open Uinta.
Like if a politician stepped up and did this, you would go head over heels. You'd be so happy, right?
You can't even see it. Literally, it's just a white piece of paper. Look at this.
Yeah.
You honestly can't see it.
I tried to say that when you initially did it, like, many, many moons ago.
And, hashtag open Uinta, politicians. Where are the politicians on this? Silent.
Typical.
I've heard nothing but silence.
They're probably using the mountain for their own plans.
If they're up there by themselves.
I'll bet Mitt Romney's on a side-by-side on the Uintas right now.
Oh,
I really do believe
gosh.
That with all of my
oh,
heart.
Oh, my gosh. If they let elected politicians get up there and not regular folks like me who dress up like scarecrows in order to go up,
what if
I'm
you
be
get
so
to
upset.
The second gate and you go, oh, I'm going to have to turn around, and you look over. Who's there zipping around? Spencer Cox, Deidre Henderson, Mike McKell's in the back seat eating popcorn.
If the politicians are up in the Uintas and that's why they're silent?
Where are they? I haven't seen one around town. Right? Where else would they be?
Hashtag open you.
I haven't seen one, dude. That's all I'm saying. I haven't physically seen one around town.
I haven't seen one either. I've not seen one. I don't know where they are. Hashtag open you into. If you want to reach out, dearclint@thebeehive.com. You can call us. You can text us. You can hit us up on social media @thebeehivehq. Use the hashtag dearclint. That's the show. Signing off for Chris Rall, Weston Tanner, Kelly Jensen. My name is Clint Betts, and this has been another episode of The Beehive.